Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for High Velocity Radio.
Welcome to High Velocity Radio. I'm Michael Lauer here with Lee Cantor. How you doing, Lee?
I am doing A-okay. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing well. Your kid came back home this weekend, didn't he?
That's right. He was at Valdosta State University for the Governor's Honors Program, and 4 weeks away. It was a vacation for me, a vacation for him. Everybody won.
Sounds good. And he's readjusting, assimilating back into society.
Assimilating back.
That's good. We've got some great guests today. I want to start off by introducing to the show Mr. Mark Donilo, a managing partner with Sales Globe. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing well, Michael. Thanks.
And you brought a special guest with you today, didn't you?
I did. Greg Johnson from LexisNexis. And Greg is an old friend and an old client and is going to talk about some of the ideas that we have today on innovation.
Great. I want to start off, you have a book that's out now, right?
Right. It's called The Innovative Sale, and it's all about how to bring creativity and innovation into sales strategy. So we have right brain processes that you can apply in a left brain world, so how to think creatively.
So now, can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to write this book?
Well, it was a long time coming. I'm what you might think of as an art school MBA, meaning I went to art school years ago. Undergrad, and I was a designer in New York for a number of years, and I was intrigued by business, and I had several roommates that had gone off to business school after a few years in their careers as stockbrokers, and I was kind of curious about what they were doing, and I helped one of them move off to business school, and I took a look around, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting, this whole business thing, and I became interested in that and went off and did my MBA. And what I realized years later is as I was interviewing for jobs, nobody wanted to hire the art guy because nobody took it seriously. They couldn't figure out how the art guy fit into a true business context. So I kind of kept that in the closet. But a while later, realized a lot of the things that we did in terms of solution development for companies involved creative principles. So the question was, how do we actually bring some of these ideas to bear so that companies can use them in their work? So it was really bringing or recognizing that we were doing a lot of those innovative things naturally anyway, and asking the question, how can we get beyond the intuitive and help people do this in a logical way that uses principles and uses a process they can apply in a repeated fashion so they can do it over and over and over and get good results from it.
Now, how does that jive, though, with creativity? Because doesn't creativity, like, you need the muse to be there and, you know, where inspiration could strike at any point? You know, how does that flow into a world where you need something that's predictable, something that's replicatable?
Right, right. I think that's one of the myths we run into, and we talk about some of those early in the book, is some of the myths of creativity or myths of innovation. So we talk about the idea that good creative ideas come out of the blue, right? So it's that moment of inspiration, that eureka moment. And when you think about when you had your last great idea, a lot of times people will say, well, you know, I was out biking, or I was in the shower, or I was doing something completely separate from my work. And it appears to be a eureka moment. What you notice, though, is that you were already thinking about it ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And what you were doing is you were working through that problem, and then you stopped and you went and you did something else. And what your mind does is it goes into a look-seek combining function. It puts ideas together. That's why when you're in the shower, all of a sudden something comes to you and you go, gosh, I never thought of that before. What did I think of? That's a great idea. Your mind was putting together illogical combinations from other places, or what we think of as parallels. So our point is that it's not always the muse, or it's not always the eureka moments. Those are culminations of things that are already going on in your thought process. So one of the principles we talk about in the book is walking away from the problem. So when you're grinding on a business problem, you don't necessarily come up with your best answers by continuing to grind on it, contrary to, you know, our work ethic. But by stepping away, your mind will actually do things, and you'll have those moments of inspiration because of your prior work.
So you have to kind of build that into the process. It's some type of walk away moment.
Right, right. We talk about the principle of movement, or being able to grow with the flow, but it's basically stepping away. So it's building that into the process. So I think one of the things you want to ask as you do something like this is this particular problem worth looking at in a creative context, or do I just need to bang out a quick solution? So if it's a solution sale, or developing a new strategy for the business, or a new strategy to work with a certain customer group, it's usually worth that time to build in to be able to step away and have that thinking time to come up with those answers.
So now, is this process something that, like, it would make sense for somebody who doesn't have a lot of sales experience because now you're starting with a blank slate and they're not having to unlearn maybe bad habits? Does this kind of work for somebody who's already kind of an experienced salesperson?
Well, it works for both. And if you think about how it fits into some of the sales methodologies that you hear about quite often, if we're working on looking at the market and figuring out which accounts we're going to target, and then we're mapping our accounts, trying to understand who the buyers and decision makers are in our accounts. And then we're setting goals. We're making commitments to ourselves or commitments to our sales team. There comes a time there where we then have to do something. We have to come up with some idea. We have to come up with some value proposition to the customer. So it's at that point usually that we have to start to get creative, because there'll be this thing that happens that's called the customer problem or the challenge or the issue that the customer will present. So it might be, you know, we need to lower cost, or we need to get a faster supply chain for a particular product. So that when that problem is presented to you, it gives you a chance to develop your value proposition. That's where the creativity comes in play. So that could be a new salesperson learning that, or somebody who can apply that to an existing sales process that they've done for years.
Now, can you share a way in real life maybe how this is they had historically gone one way, and then after learning this process, then they were able to make some adjustments?
Right. So, one example I can think of is a company that's in the printing and paper business. And a very typical type of issue they would encounter, and one really simple example is a customer coming to them. They had an insurance company customer that said, we need to lower the cost of our paper. And on the first level, what they would do is they'd probably go back and figure out, well, can we increase quantity? Can we lower the per unit cost? What can we do to work it out? And so the first thing they go to is the calculator, and they try to come out with a mathematical answer. By stepping back and asking some questions around the market that that customer is trying to serve and what they're trying to offer in terms of the product, and also maybe in terms of their use case or how they're trying to get it done or the resources, they can ask additional questions and they can develop a better problem statement. So, for example, we can take that question of how can I lower the cost of paper, and we can ask questions about, well, what market are you trying to serve? Well, we're trying to serve our high-end property and casualty customers. Okay, well, what product are you trying to address? Well, it's actually our premium product for them. In terms of resources, what are you trying to deal with? Well, we have to differentiate because they're going to be comparing us to other competitors. And in fact, our marketing department's been downsized, so we need to cut costs there. And so all of a sudden, we have a more granular problem statement, which is how can we help them address problems or address providing the right type of collateral to their high-end insurance customers for that high-end product, and provide marketing advice because they don't have a marketing department. And we get off of the cost question. So by asking a better problem or coming up with a better problem statement, we can then start solving something differently than maybe our competitor is doing, who's back there working on the calculator just trying to come up with a lower cost. So we become a better advisor.
Right. So, and to ask more questions seems counterintuitive for a lot of salespeople. They're typically think they're in the answer business. Right. That they're just, well, I got to solve this. But their problem, they told me that they want a lower price. So I have to figure out a way to give them a lower price. And you're saying, as counterintuitive as it might sound, is instead of answering that question directly, you're asking more questions to really get to the heart of the outcome they're trying to achieve.
Exactly. I think because we're all professionals and experts at what we do, we're very quick to come up with an answer. And we have this thing called a quota or a goal, which says we have to hit a number in a certain period of time. And so we want to move fast. So we go back to the last couple or three things that maybe we've done, and we apply those ideas because that's the most expedient thing to do. But it also sets us up to look exactly like everybody else and be non-differentiated. So when you go back to that question of what inspired this, it was some of that thinking, which is the question of why. Why do we tend to replicate the same old solutions over and over? Why do we, quote, benchmark other companies about how they do it? It's not because we want to know how they do it. It's because we want to know what to do. So we tend to copy. We'll look at, how the alpha dog in the room did it at IBM, and we'll just tend to replicate
that. And we'll just try to be a little better. Right.
Exactly. And so we get incrementally better. We develop a couple of ideas instead of doing divergent thinking, and we jump to a solution that sets us up, you know, to be what one author called funnel fodder. So we're just up there ready to be knocked out by the competition because we look like everybody else.
So now part of this, it sounds like you're trying to move away from any type of transactional selling to a more of a problem-solving, solution-selling.
Relationship-based kind of thing?
Well, yeah, this would apply to situations where you need to come up with a solution for the customer. So it could be more solution-based selling or problem-solving selling. It can also apply to transactional selling at a higher level. So, for example, if I have a very simple product, very simple service, maybe I'm selling it through a call center, I may not have to come up with a unique solution every time as a salesperson. But as a sales leader or a sales manager, applying this process might help me to think more innovatively about the overall sales process for the business. Mm-hmm. So it may not have to be transaction by transaction, but it might be how are we doing these transactions overall, and is there a better way for us to differentiate in our business model?
So now, when you're trying to train a person to think creatively, is this something that the person can you teach someone to be creative, or is this something that you're born with and you just got to hire the right people?
Right. Yeah, and that's a great point. Another one of the potential myths. So we put up an example of a right brain person and a left brain person. So we put up an example of, for example, Andy Warhol compared to Albert Einstein. And we go, well, who's the most creative person? Can you learn to be creative? And arguably, Einstein could have been more creative than Warhol, right? My whole point around learning creativity is the reason we have design schools, the reason we have art schools, the reason we have architecture schools is because people learn how to do these things. So, there are people that are naturally, intuitively creative. Thinking about it that way, though, really limits it to the people that just have that gift and they can't quite explain how they do it. So the answer is yes. And I've been searching for that for years, right, because I went through art school and I didn't learn a process per se. But then years later, you know, my left brain kicked in and I said, well, how do we actually do these things? And we broke it apart and we broke it down to about 8 basic steps and a number of different principles that you can put behind it. So, yes, we can teach people to do that. And that's the fun thing when we do these innovative sale workshops is watching the lights go on with salespeople that haven't done this before. So we start to do some brainstorming around parallel ideas, and we start to do some divergent thinking and putting components together, and all of a sudden, bam, ideas are coming out, and they're going, where did that come from? It's because I was following a process, and it created those ideas. They did it themselves.
Now, do you find that some of the salespeople kind of self-select themselves out and say, I'm not creative, that, you know, I can't do that?
Yeah, I think you've got your numbers people that are just more predisposed to moving through a quick process, more predisposed to working the numbers. I don't think you need to use every piece of the process. It's probably a way of looking at that, which is if you're an extreme left brainer and can apply a couple ideas from this, that can even help.
Right.
You know, we want to make this so that it's not something where you have to load a boxcar of innovation in, but you can say, hey, you know, I can understand this concept or that concept, and I can apply it to my thinking, and I can start to make right. that, you know, part of what I do.
Now, you mentioned 8 steps. Can you share those 8 steps?
Right. So in the beginning, as I mentioned, you usually are presented with a problem, so it's a customer challenge. So the first step is really defining that customer challenge, or maybe more appropriately, redefining that customer challenge, so not taking it at face value. And that in itself... In any one of these, if you just do it well, will help you tremendously. But that in itself is a big differentiator because you start from a different starting point than your competitors if you can redefine the problem.
Now, are you doing that on your own or are you doing that with the client?
Preferably with the client. So,
you're working together
right.
to solve this problem.
Right. And so that that comes into part of the consultative process. So it's hard to answer those questions yourself.
Right.
Right. So
but sometimes a client will say, hey, solve this. And then the team goes off in a room and then they're working on solving the problem. And maybe they don't have as much information as they'd like.
Right. Well, you know, the collaboration and working together on solving the problems, I think, produces a much richer result in the end, because you can only go so far, so many iterations on your own before you have to come back and ask for that information. Mm-hmm. So that in itself is a major foundational piece. Gathering insight is the second step, which is really connects to that first step, which is as you ask these questions around product, market, et cetera, you need to continue to get insight from your customer or client. You need to get insight also from other places, other reference points. So it could be outside of your client doing additional research. Your initial approach is a third step. So that is typically the brainstorming that a group will do. So the innovation roadblock I think a lot of companies will hit is they'll get to that first point, which is, okay, let's do some brainstorming. Let's come up with a few ideas. That was a great session. Okay, let's take those and talk about how we can implement them. So they jump right over to implementation because going beyond that is a step that they're not familiar with, which is we start getting into the area of lost, which is they're not quite sure what they're doing at that point or how to get creative.
Right.
Fourth step is getting into destroying false constraints. A lot of things that hold us back are the way we've always done it before, or constraints that are in the business, and we'll typically see three flavors of constraints. You'll see operational constraints, and these are the things that you have to have in place to run the business. So we mentioned an insurance company a few minutes ago. An operational constraint for them would be, say, underwriting guidelines. So you can't destroy those or you end up destroying the business. Procedural constraints would be processes that the company's followed over the years. So we have a certain sales process.
Mm-hmm.
Those are things that you can take apart and you can change those types of constraints. And then accepted truths. You know, we've always done it this way.
Right.
Those are ripe for breaking or destroying. So we want to destroy those constraints as a major step. And then you want to get into some of the creative steps of combining parallels. So we look for examples from other places. From other sources in business. So it could be how our company's done it before. It could be how our competitors have done it before. It could be how companies with similar business models have done it before. So we go into five different generations of parallels in terms of understanding where we can find sources of ideas. And those sources of ideas are not necessarily trying to solve your whole problem, but we might take our problem statement and break it into pieces. In each one of those pieces, we might find a parallel that we then combine together to come up with something completely
right,
new.
Because a lot of times the answer could be in a totally different industry. It could be unrelated, seemingly
right.
unrelated, but
mm-hmm.
it could be, if you just take that one slice out, it a similar thing could be happening elsewhere if you
right.
open your
right.
mind to it. And a lot of people who are industry-specific, kind of just living in that world, they're not seeing an outside world. So all their answers tend to be in that kind of vacuum mm-hmm. of their industry.
Yep. Exactly. So if we can take a little piece from different places and combine those pieces
right.
together.
And that's important from a company standpoint, I would think, to foster that that it's okay to have a life outside of your industry and your business, right? To open your mind, because you never know where this kind of the good idea could and where you can steal somebody who has a good idea maybe in a totally opposite like in the art world or the design world, and
mm-hmm.
you're in manufacturing, that you can steal something and then add it to your repertoire.
Right. And that gets out to what we might call the fourth or fifth generation of parallels, which is getting beyond business.
Right.
And starting to find, you know, other sources. One of my favorite examples is we think of the moving assembly line that was created by Henry Ford, and we think, wow, that was such a unique innovation. When in fact that was a combination of things. So Ford had his people take a look at the meat processing or meat packing plants in Chicago and in Cleveland, and what they saw there were the people moving the carcasses of the meat down a rail, and they would take a knife and they would slice off a certain piece and they would slide it to the next guy and he would slice off another piece, and it was essentially a moving disassembly line.
Right.
So he took this parallel completely outside of his business and he said, well, gosh, we could actually put cars together that way. And then the assembly lines were happening as part of the Industrial Revolution. So there were a couple of pieces he was able to combine together. And,
right.
And indeed, the initial assembly lines that Ford used, they were pulling cars through on ropes. A lot like they did with the meat.
The meat, right? Because that's what
that's
he was stealing
had,
from, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you get into combining those ideas. You get into horizontal thinking, which is we tend to think of as divergent thinking. So how do I come up with a range of ideas? And then you start to look at those and figure out which ones are going to make sense. And you go into your vertical development and your implementation or your communication and figure mm-hmm. out how you're going to integrate that in. So those are, you know, some of the big steps in the process that we will look at.
And then you cover this when you do your workshops?
Right. Well, you know, the reality is in a workshop, depending, you know, if we do a one-day workshop, we will hit a few pieces of that. We kind of use the analogy, it's like opening up a 100-proof bottle of whiskey here. You know, you can't slug the whole thing down in one shot. So there's a lot in this, in that it takes several sessions and then a lot of practice to learn these different areas. So we'll pick a few of those out. But the main idea is this. We want to give people some components that they can start to practice, and we want them to start to build it into their creative muscle memory.
Right.
So the analogy we think of is kind of like a golf swing, right? So I've been playing golf for probably 30 years or more. Hate to count how many. And I've taken many, many lessons. And you learn about all these different things, from keeping your head down and the grip and the stance and the takeaway and the follow-through. And so you'll learn, you know, 25 or 30 mechanical pieces of just that one golf swing. But when you get up on the first tee to hit the ball, you know, what do you think about? Other than don't shank it in the woods, you're usually thinking about one or two things, right? And the rest is in your muscle memory. So that's the same idea here. We want to give people a couple of things they can think about so it doesn't become a difficult process, but it becomes a quick process that's part of how they think. So we're basically, you know, if I can get a little psychological here, we're carving new neural pathways so that they're actually changing the way they think. So they automatically start thinking, oh, I need to look at some parallel ideas. Or, you know what, I need to really make sure this is the problem that we're trying to solve. I'm just not going to take it at face value.
And you don't want them to be, like, paralyzed by the information either.
Right, exactly. So we look at the book itself as kind of like a mini encyclopedia of these processes, and then you can start to apply them. And as you get better, you can add additional ones as you go.
Well, you brought somebody with you. Why don't you introduce Greg and then tell us how you guys have worked together?
Great. So Greg Johnson is here with me from LexisNexis. And Greg and I have worked over a number of years, initially starting with incentive programs for LexisNexis, and then worked on some customer segmentation and some sales strategy. So we worked on a range of different things. But Greg, in his role, is a creative thinker. Greg needs to look at customer problems in depth and also look at strategy in depth, and has applied some of these ideas. So I wanted to bring Greg here to maybe share a few thoughts and some practical application of how he does creative thinking.
Well, I appreciate it. Greg, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Now, Greg, can you give us an overview of what LexisNexis does kind of in general, and then maybe specifically what your role is?
Sure. So LexisNexis is part of a broader organization, Reed Elsevier, and our business is built around acquiring data assets that we then provide to our customers to help them improve the quality of the outcome of the decisions they're making. In some examples, if you look at the risk business, which is where Mark and I met, we help insurance carriers. Mark mentioned insurance. Any claim that is registered in the United States comes into a database that we keep that allows the insurance carriers to price transactions, knowing what your history is not only with them but with other insurance carriers. We use information to validate identities that allow us to then go on and do things for banks, such as anti-money laundering prevention, compliance with the Patriot Act, and things like that. So a lot of different uses for our data, but all about aggregating information to be able to help business professionals make better decisions.
And then where does the selling come in from your standpoint?
You know, so The selling in particular relative to Mark's world, and you know, we're working on going out and meeting with customers in basically any industry, including direct to consumer. And when you go in and you're talking with some of these larger organizations, it's really important that you do differentiate yourself. There's a lot of people out there. It's a bunch of highly competitive industries. And to be able to go in and provide them with a method by which to solve their problem in a unique way is important. Mark's, what he put together in this book, I think does a great job of providing that outline or a set of guidelines that you can use as a sales professional that absolutely differentiates you from your competitors. Many customers that we run into, they're running just as fast as everybody else in the world. They have a problem. Their boss has come in and said, you know, XYZ, I need this fixed. They jump into something. They leave out a lot of the things that you guys have already talked about this morning, only because they're running fast. So if somebody can go in as a sales professional and kind of slow the process down, ask the questions, check the boxes, look at other people in the same industry, look at other people in other industries, et cetera, it puts you in a whole different position in terms of really being able to get to the root of the problem and then come up with the best overall solution to the problem.
Now, in your role at LexisNexis, are you managing a team?
I've got a team of several different teams that work for me. The biggest group is sales and customer facing consultants. So they're not sales reps per se, but they're the consultants that support our sales teams. Our sales reps are generalists, and so they cover an account, and we have a team of consultants who are essentially the subject matter experts that go in and meet with the customers on very specific topics.
Now, when you heard about Mark's ideas about being creative and all this, is it hard to disseminate that to your people that are responsible for numbers? You know, where they're like, look, creative's great, but I gotta have a quota. I gotta sell some stuff by the end of the month.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think that a lot of people in sales or in business don't fancy themselves to be artists, right? I certainly don't, although my kids come to me and ask me to draw things for them for homework all the time. Some of the funniest looking horses you've ever seen. But so I think we as business professionals don't fancy ourselves to have that artistic gene. And therefore, there's usually a little bit of resistance in terms of, boy, I love the concept, but how does that apply to me? Because I'm not that artist that they're talking about. But as soon as you lay out the high level of what it's about, and that happened even just this morning prior to leaving my office, people say, this is an interesting way of looking at it and a great framework by which to pursue innovation, whether it be innovation with a customer or internal innovation within an organization.
And in your world, and I'm sure in Mark's as well, relationships are critical, right? You have to have these deep relationships, especially in anything that has any complexity in the selling process, right? That's relationships are even more important, right? And so I'm sure the salespeople conceptually understand the importance of relationships and the importance of how creativity and consultative selling can fit in.
Mm-hmm.
But that pressure of making numbers, you know, when push comes to shove, aren't they just trying to sometimes maybe close too fast or try to solve a problem too quickly in order to make the sale rather than to really serve the client in the best possible way?
Absolutely. And the other side is the pressure from the customers on the salespeople is tremendous as well. You know, think about the last time you went to buy a car. How long did you want to hear about the features and functions of a car? Right, you'd done most of that work before you showed up at the dealership, and it was more, I want to know what your price is. Customers are the exact same with our sales professionals, and you know, you end up in the office of the head of procurement, and they're pushing for, give me your price, let me know what it is.
Right, because they're just filling out a form and they're putting data in the form, and they don't really care about knowing that you help your kid draw horses, right? They got appointments, right? They're trying to achieve a goal.
Yeah. Well, if they saw the horses I drew, they would definitely not buy from me, but that's okay. Exactly right. And oftentimes what you find is the person that is actually going to use the solution may not be the person that is procuring the solution.
Right.
So getting to that person or that group of people and really understanding the problem, there's a good chance that you're going to come out with something that will be vastly different than what your competitors will bring because they're just looking in, and it's the good old, you know, when you have a hammer in your bag, everything looks like a nail.
Right.
But maybe there's a screw. Maybe there's a hex screw these days, whatever it might be, and you need a different tool to be able to solve that problem.
That's a great point about how now today's consumer is a lot different than yesterday's consumer. Mark, and I'd like your opinion on this. Now the consumer is coming to the table fully educated or a lot more educated than maybe previously, whereas previously the salesperson was a source of information. And now a lot of times the consumer on their own through the internet and through white papers and all kinds of stuff and seminars and conferences is coming to the table highly educated. And they think they already have this figured out, and now they're just choosing amongst a couple of things they've already narrowed down. But you, as the sales expert for your company, you know you have some secret sauce that maybe they're not aware of, and you just need to have that opportunity to tell the story so that they can understand that we're not a commodity item amongst several competitors, that we do listen and we do consult. Is there a way, some coaching you can give or share to help a person kind of work their way through this?
Well, I think it's getting that that deeper understanding of what they're trying to accomplish. Because if they come to you and they're really at the level where they're sourcing based on price, there's something that they've done in terms of their initial homework that if you can understand, that could be more revealing to help you differentiate. If they are really just sourcing based on price, one of the things that I'm not averse to is saying, look, we may not be the right choice for you, because if we're just playing on price, that's not necessarily our value proposition.
Right.
You know, we may or may not be the lowest price or the middle price, or we may be the highest price, but it's not a price situation. So I think for me, I've got to work back into, okay, where were you coming from and what is it you're truly trying to solve, even if you've already done that homework.
So being really clear on what outcome that the client is trying to achieve is a critical step in this process.
Right. And in fact, and you know, you can get into all sorts of sales conversations, but if they're trying to get to a certain outcome and they're buying on price, you have to back into questions like, what's the cost of errors or what's the cost of quality? Because that can quickly take price out of the equation.
Right.
As soon as we have a mistake or rework or something that's not really what they need.
And that's why defining what that outcome is, you know, the outcome really may not be price. The outcome is having a happy customer, and the happy customer is one that has less mistakes and solves a problem faster.
Right, right. Right. And in fact, if you're in that situation, you mentioned relationship before, you may have not had an opportunity to build that relationship and build that trust, because the clients we work with, it's usually not a price conversation, because they know they're going to get something of a certain quality.
Right.
So that's beyond the price, because they've worked with us before.
You know, I think, Mark, that's an important point, too. If you're to the point in the sale where you're just being called at the time that somebody's ordering, then you probably miss the opportunity. Where I see the real applicability of this process in the innovative sale is for a sales professional to be able to go plan with their customer in advance before there's a deal, and to look at what their strategy is and to understand what their problems, plural, are, and really develop a more comprehensive approach to it, and potentially enlighten the customer as to problems they weren't aware of and or solve, you know, those problems that weren't even, quote-unquote, didn't have a deal on the table at the time, and become a trusted partner by walking them through this process and taking the time to do it.
Right. Co-ownership and co-development of the solution, I think, is the key. And the actual sale is incidental. That's just a formality.
Right. Because that'll organically happen if you have that deep relationship and you're co-creating it with the client.
Right, right. If our focus is on the proposal and the price, then we may have missed it, as you're
too
saying,
late.
Greg.
Yeah.
Right, it might be too late. So now, Greg, how do you implement this information? Is this a book that you share with your team? Do you do workshops? How do you kind of get some of the learning out of Mark's brain and into your team's brain?
What we're doing is we're in the process of rolling it out to the different groups within my organization and doing it through seminars. Mark initially came in and met with all of the leaders on my team and enlightened them, so to speak, on how this could be used. And it was interesting in that meeting, because the concept was sort of, intriguing, we'll listen. And about, you know, a third of the way or less through it, they were all sitting there saying, wow, I could really see where this could be useful. So it didn't take long for the lights to go on, and now it's just a matter of getting the teams through it and exposing them to the thought process.
Now, what was some of their initial hesitancy about this?
I guess the initial hesitancy was more just, is this another strategy du jour or approach du jour type of thing? Another consultant coming in.
With
the
book, right?
No, and they get it all the time. I have obviously spent a lot of time with Mark on this and other subjects. So it's a nice extension of the other things that we've worked on.
Right.
But even better, I think what they realized was, whether it's working with customers or guiding their internal activities around innovation, I think they saw it as applicable more broadly in problem solving than just a sales campaign with a customer.
That's right. The problem-solving element is really important in this whole process. So right. Any tool that you have at your disposal that can help that, that's a win just on that.
Right. So to be specific, I think any hesitancy was gone in the first 15 minutes of Mark's presentation when they started to really understand what there was to this.
So if our listener out there has a sales team, is this something you think the book is the easiest entry point?
I think the book is a great way to do it. Yeah, having Mark come in, or I've never really talked about a WebEx or something, but the book is a great starting point for the salespeople to be able to develop their skills.
And from the book, what is your, like, if you can share one key takeaway, what would that be that was most meaningful for you?
Well, there's a lot, actually, but I think the notion of the generations in the combining of the parallels, and being able to look at the different places to identify potential solutions, I think that was one that I liked a lot. The other one that is right up there is this notion of get comfortable with feeling lost, and this whole notion of be innovative and the pressure you feel to have that answer quickly. And frankly, in the times when I've been most innovative, there is a long period of feeling lost. And
just get comfortable around that and not be afraid of it and just give an answer just to not be lost.
Correct.
But to just kind of sit in that moment for a little bit and let something happen.
And endure the pressure that comes either from the customer seeking the answer or from a boss seeking an answer and regular updates. And those updates become potentially vague for a little while until you can kind of go through this process. And if you can articulate then this process to the people, your constituents, if you will, then it makes it easier for them to understand that you are going through this and that you are going to have a clear path and there will be an outcome, but hang with me type of thing.
Right. And to really educate each constituent that's part of the process and it's okay, so don't freak out about it, right?
Correct. And Mark and I were talking in the hallway this morning and reflecting on this over the weekend. I said, the best thing I like about this is it creates a single common language.
Right.
I'm always about having everybody talking about things using a common language, because my use of one word may be completely different than your definition of the
right.
same word. But by having everybody understand what you're doing with this, then it makes it a heck of a lot easier for people to, be patient with it and to understand how they can contribute to it, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. I think even in our internal conversations when we're working on client engagements, that type of language comes into play. So we'll say, okay, well, we're at a period of lost here, and we acknowledge that, and it takes the pressure off because we go,
right.
Okay, that's part of the process. Mm-hmm. Or, let's walk away from the problem, and we don't try to figure it out on while in one.
So that way you don't force yourself into a bad decision. You just understand, look, we're not clear yet, so let's just hang with this a little bit longer.
Right. And then, going back to the muses and the fairies and the eureka moments, that allows those ideas to process in your
mind. That's where they live, right?
That's where they live. And then they start coming back, right, right. And then you're ready to come back to that problem.
So now, Greg, can you share maybe some any feedback from your team members regarding this?
I think thus far, what they've all done is been able to look at this and apply it to their day to day in a positive light. I don't know that any of them, I think Mark touched on this earlier, any of them necessarily have the official checklist of every one of the steps.
Right.
But they've incorporated this into their thinking on a regular basis. So whether it's and I would say in a lot of cases where they're still working it in with their teams, they're doing it in more the leadership and coaching kind of way, and baking some of the thoughts into their coaching of their consultants who are directly in front of the customers, which gives us another advantage because there's also a lot of coaching that those consultants do with our sales team. So kind of percolating that down into the sales organization almost unknowingly in their minds because they haven't seen the book and the sales team specifically yet.
And then this helps with the culture of the company as a whole to be consultative and to listen and to problem solve, right?
Absolutely. And for me, it's always all about how do you establish yourself and your organization as a trusted partner of the customer as opposed to a vendor. I know.
Right,
I don't
a commodity. Or right?
Bad words. I don't like those, right?
Exactly.
They buy from partners, and if you can be a partner, then you're involved in strategic conversations with the executives of the organization and avoiding what I call the vendor Olympics that are not a lot of fun most days.
And then this way, when your customer knows you're truly trying to solve a problem where you may or may not be the solution, I mean, that's a higher level relationship, right?
Correct. Yep, absolutely the case. And we see it all the time. You talked about finding the solutions in unique places. Sometimes partners are a key to it. You might realize, hey, I don't know this, but I do know somebody who can do it, and I can put you in touch with them, and you create partnerships and that help the clients, and that shows that you're not just there for the deal, but you're there to help them out in totality, and I think that, once again, puts you in a whole different place.
Well, Mark, this must be pretty rewarding for you to see some of your work in action like this and having somebody that you work with implemented in this manner.
Well, it is, Leah. I think the best part, the most exciting part, is when you see the lights go on, you see those clickover points where people start getting it, they start using it, they start saying, hey, I tried this and it actually worked. That's the most exciting part, because, you know, what's happening there? Well, we're transferring ideas, we're transferring learning, and we're transferring the way they're actually being able to think.
And so what's next for you?
Well, I think the next really is working through and helping teams with this. I think there's so much in it that we really want to see organizations start to apply this to their businesses.
Mm-hmm. And then if somebody wanted to learn more about the book?
They can go to salesglobe.com, and there's information on the book on salesglobe.com. They can also go to amazon.com and find the book there, and they can actually read. I think they have a couple of sample chapters out there as well.
And for you, what's next for LexisNexis? What do you guys got going on?
We are just continuing to innovate and evolve our business, getting a lot closer to our customers every single day, and a lot of challenges lie ahead. So really just trying to keep the innovation going and you know, stay ahead of things with our customers.
And website, if people want to learn more?
It is www.risk.lexisnexis.com.
All right. Well, thank you both for being part of the show today.
Great. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
We will see you all next time on High Velocity Radio.